On today's Encore edition of the 21st, are mom and dad still going to the store? Or maybe your brother or sister isn't wearing a face covering or taking social distancing seriously? We'll talk to a psychologist about how to have those important but uncomfortable conversations about the pandemic.
I think a lovely opening question would be to say, can you just talk to me a bit about what is so hard for you about this?
Then kids in the String Project at Illinois State University have taken their spring concert virtual. We'll take a listen. Plus, writer Elizabeth Segrin has researched hobbies. She'll explain how they benefit our physical and mental health and why now is a good time to pursue one. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Most of today's show is on tape, what we call an encore broadcast, some of our favorite segments from the last couple months. But this is new. As we go to air Thursday morning, Illinois is reporting nearly 84,700 known cases of COVID-19, including 3,792 deaths from the disease. Today on the broadcast, we check in with student musicians, college age and younger, about having to go without their traditional spring recitals. And we'll talk to an expert on hobbies who says having to stay at home for weeks on end might be the perfect time to pick one up. But first, every Thursday on the 21st, we discuss a different mental health topic. Today, we wanted to revisit a conversation with Alexandra Solomon, a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University and a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychology. She specializes in the field of marriage and family relationships. Dr. Solomon joined the 21st just days after Illinois' stay-at-home order went into effect. She was sharing some tips about how to talk to friends and family, or strangers, who we feel maybe aren't taking physical distancing guidelines seriously enough. She also shared some advice about what to do when we just need some space from loved ones with whom we might be cooped up. She spoke with Illinois Newsroom's Reginald Hardwick on the show March 26th, but we thought her wisdom could be especially helpful now as we approach the end of our eighth week of Illinois' stay-at-home order. Here's that interview.
Alexandra, I'm sure many of our listeners know someone who maybe isn't taking these stay-at-home directions very seriously. What are you hearing?
Yes, I do think that, you know, we could plot all of us on a spectrum from, you know, life as usual to incredibly hunkered down. And even if, you know, our mother or father is responding responsibly, if they're one degree less serious about it than we are, it can be cause for tremendous anxiety and upset because we, you know, there even just that little difference can spark a lot of feelings in us.
And what about when someone we know, like a parent, for example, they may be over 60 at more risk of complications for COVID-19, still doing things, you know, maybe that they're not supposed to do, like going to the store when mm-hmm. it's crowded or seeing a small group of friends. I think I saw a picture on Twitter about all the folks walking up in the Chicago area together on the path. What do you give that advice to a parent without creating conflict?
Well, exactly. So what I want us to avoid is kind of coming in, you know, already upset and coming in with sweeping statements like you always or you never or you're being so. And I really want people to lead with a lot of curiosity. So I think a lovely opening question to a parent who is behaving in our eyes recklessly would be to say, can you just talk to me a bit about what is so hard for you about this? Like a genuine curiosity of, just help me understand how this has been for you, like what's difficult for you. And that may give us a little bit of insight and then a bit of leverage later on in the conversation. But that whole problem solving, we need to hold off on until we have really just kind of, what a therapist would say, held space for. That we lead with empathy and we hold space for just like, tell me, mom, what's hard for you about this? Like, talk me through what it's been like for you to have your, you know, your style cramped, your life shrunk down.
Now, this is 2020, and we know a lot of people are on social media. And today, even I was looking at an exchange with folks, and there are definitely folks who cite certain sources of information, may not be legitimate news sources, but they really believe what they're reading, or they've heard, you know, there's more flu deaths than coronavirus, and they may not get their whole minds around the explosion of cases. And they're going to, maybe they're going to cite those facts. How do you have that talk without going into a lot of conflict?
Well, I agree. I think that is one of the biggest challenges is when family members are getting their news from different places where there isn't kind of listening to scientists and taking this as seriously. And that is definitely an uphill battle. So I think, again, I worry about families getting into my news versus your news. And I want families to really stay focused on the relationship. And then the next move may be to say, can you help me? Can you help me? I'm incredibly anxious and I'm afraid and I'm worried. And it would be so loving of you to really follow these recommendations to help me out. So that may be a way of just really talking about what my experience is. Sometimes in my field, we talk about an XYZ statement. So when you continue to hang out with your friends during this time of social distancing, I feel scared and angry. So when you do X in situation Y, I feel Z. So when we can frame it like an XYZ statement, and we're really inviting our parent to see how hard this is for me. When you're hanging out with your friends, I feel so scared. I want you around for a very long time. So enlisting our parent to see our struggle, our fear, our worry may help us towards that end goal more effectively than trading news sources back and forth.
We were talking about talking to your parent. Let's talk about your adult child who is no longer underage, but, you know, has their own mind. But again, you really care for them and they're taking social, but they're not taking social distancing seriously. How would you speak to them?
Yes, I think this is another twist, you know, an equally challenging situation is for a parent to accept the limits of their control, right? So a parent can lead with empathy. They can sort of say, you know, I want you to be responsible. We all have a duty here. And then at that point, at some point, if it really feels like we're spinning our wheels and our adult child isn't listening to us, then it does become a shift into, okay, so then here's where I need to put a boundary. Because if you aren't going to take care of yourself and the people around you, I at least need to be protecting myself, right? So there's some effort to connect, some effort to influence, and then at some point it becomes an issue of boundaries. If you aren't going to protect yourself, I at least am going to need to make the choice to protect myself.
And teenagers, I imagine, is another group. I'm sure parents of teenagers might be struggling right now with school out in Illinois. How do you keep all these teens from, you know, automatically getting together and you know, and even younger, but keeping them 6 feet apart if they do get together?
It's so hard. It is so hard. So I mostly just want to validate how incredibly difficult this is and how very real it is for teenagers. You know, we know that for teenagers, developmentally, their peer group matters a lot. They aren't just trying to be a pain in their parents' neck. They just really anchor their developmental, you know, lives and their on their peer group. So I encourage parents to just have a lot of latitude around FaceTime and screen time. And I think that those are the stories I hear. I'm the mother of teenagers, and those are the stories I'm hearing, that there's lots of, you know, FaceTime hangouts. And thank goodness that this generation is so fluid and fluent on their phones. And so they can create opportunities. My daughter and her friend did a little personality quiz together last night and spent some time on the phone together doing that and being a bit creative about, you know, how they could be together while they're apart. But it really is. It's incumbent, painful as it is, to have empathy for our kids. This isn't easy, but then also to have clear expectations and agreements.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with psychology professor at Northwestern University, Alexandra Solomon. She also has a psychotherapy practice. She's giving us some strategies on how to talk to loved ones about taking social distancing rules seriously to stop the spread of coronavirus. One thing that a lot of people are wondering, you know, you're in this space all together. Maybe you're used to your independent lives, and then you do need some space because you're all under the same roof. You know, how do you say, you know what, I do need some time away from family, you know, and I'm not used to this, without hurting everyone else's feelings?
Yeah. I mean, the truth of the matter is we are all scared and we are all stressed. And when we are feeling that way, our emotional reserves can get a bit depleted. So we may have a sharper tongue than we usually do. We may feel less patient than we usually do. And so the biggest thing we want to be doing is just damage control. So if I'm feeling like my fuse is short and I may say something to my family members that I'm going to regret later, I'm going to say something like, I love us too much to continue this conversation. I'm going to step away and take a break. And that way I'm taking responsibility for I'm not saying you're making me crazy, you're making me mad, because nobody is making me feel any kind of way. That's just the way I'm feeling. And so I'm going to step away lovingly and calm myself down before I say something that that I'm going to regret. That's the biggest thing, is just that's the tricky thing with anger and irritation, is it feels in the moment like we have to say this thing, we have to get this out, we have to deal with this right now. In fact, we don't. In fact, our most important sort of compass north at this time, our guiding principle here, needs to just be limiting the damage we do, and just remembering that everybody in our house has had their worlds upside down, and that can help us connect back to a sense of compassion and grace, you know, for ourselves and for the people that we are sharing space with.
I think we talked about this a little bit last week. You know, there are mental health services, and maybe they might have to kind of do things differently, maybe over FaceTime. But what should one do if you think you need, you know, some additional help right now, or just reaching out to therapy? And are those services kind of booked up, really?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, just because we are, you know, stuck in our homes does not mean that we can't be doing therapy. And I'm connected to obviously a large network of therapists, and we all, you know, we've all transitioned to teletherapy. So we're working via Zoom or other, you know, web-based platforms and doing therapy. So the Family Institute where I work, we have offices all over the Chicagoland area. We have sliding scale services where we set fees based on families' income. We also take health insurance and have some out-of-pocket clinicians as well. And so that's, the Family Institute is a great resource, a great place to start in terms of individual, couple, and family therapy, all of which can be done, you know, remotely, screen to screen at this time. And certainly it is a time where having some therapy, some additional support is essential.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about friends and family. What about strangers? So we do still have to go to the grocery store and pick up some things, and there might be times where it's a little more crowded, or maybe someone's walking. You know, you're on a sidewalk and you're a little bit close. How do you gently remind strangers, you know, I'm practicing social distancing without offending them?
I love the way you just said it. It's so gentle. I'm practicing social distancing. It's so much more gentle than you need to step back, or you're too close to me, or step back, or what are you doing, right? So so really just locating the comment within ourselves. I'm practicing social distancing. Or stepping ourselves back, you know. I went to the grocery store yesterday, and it was so strange. It's so strange to be frightened of fellow human beings, right? To not want somebody else to be near me. But I needed to go in this particular, you know, freezer cabinet, and I waited for somebody to step away. And so if we take the responsibility of walking into a space and knowing that we are going to take responsibility for where our bodies are in space, I think that's really helpful. Strange and sad, but helpful. And it's what it means right now to be a good citizen, isn't it?
I wonder, you know, we know first responders and doctors kind of prepare for these kind of situations. Do you do that as well in the mental health field?
Yes, I think it's now is a more important time than ever for us as therapists to be having lots of time for peer consultation and to be talking to each other and just having, you know, having our finger on the pulse of what are some of the dynamics that we're seeing, and how are you handling this, and how am I handling this. And one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is with our ongoing clients, you know, our client maybe came in with a marital issue, and now we are having to kind of walk this line of working on the original problem they came into therapy with, while also working on whatever this current crisis is kicking up. Because that is one thing that is certain, is that the crisis right now, having to change our lives as much as we do, it can really wake up some old traumas, some old wounds, whether that be about some financial insecurity that maybe we grew up without very much, with, you know, bare cupboards and some food insecurity. But maybe now we live as an adult with bounty and plenty. But at a time like this, it can sort of awaken those old feelings and those old fears. So we as therapists are talking a lot about how can we have an ear towards our clients' current concerns, but also listening for ways that this current crisis may be stirring up old stuff in them that is sort of surprising and confusing, and helping our clients make sense of that.
That was Reginald Hardwick speaking with Alexandra Solomon, a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University, where she's also clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychology. We'd love to hear what you thought about our conversation today or anything else we talk about on the show. You can send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Better yet, you might even want to send us a voice memo. We might use it on air. Once again, that email address is talk@21stshow.org. You can also, of course, tweet us @21stshow. Coming up, we're going to be checking in with some student musicians, both college age and even younger, as they're missing out on recital season. We're also going to be talking with writer Elizabeth Segrin, who's done a lot of reporting on hobbies and interviewed hobby experts. Yes, there are actual hobby experts. She says now might be the perfect time, staying at home for weeks and weeks on end, to pick up a new activity. That's coming up after a short break here on the 21st. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to this encore broadcast of the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. For music students of all ages, end-of-year recitals and concerts are important milestones in one's development. And for college students, they're not just milestones, but a requirement for earning a degree. But with Illinois' stay-at-home order extending through at least the end of May, there will not be any concerts anytime soon. To talk about this, last month I spoke with Kate Lewis, who teaches viola at Illinois State University. She also invited several of her students to join us, both college students and, as we'll hear, some younger children from the community. Like a lot of music classes and everything else these days, we spoke over Zoom. I began by asking her why public performance is such an important part of music education.
Well, first of all, the two students I have with me today are performance majors, so they are interested in doing this as part of their career, going out and giving recitals in different types of venues, whether it be with orchestras or solo recitals or chamber music recitals. So it's a way of practicing that. It's also really a kind of a culmination of all of the semesters of applied instruction they've taken, all of the private lessons they've had, really since the time that they were small children through their college or graduate studies.
And as we mentioned, you're on the faculty at Illinois State, and I want to come back to your Illinois State students that you have with you. But in addition to teaching college students, you're involved in something called the ISU String Project. Can you tell us what is that?
Sure. This is a program where our music education majors and our music performance majors learn practical teaching skills with students from our community. So at ISU, we have a string project with 140 children in grades 3 through 8. And we have a staff of over 20 student teachers that work with them both in orchestra classes, small group classes, and private lessons.
And I gather there's usually a big concert or a recital at the end of the school year?
There is. It's a really, really fun celebration for all of us. Our concert was scheduled for May 3rd, and it was going to be just such a wonderful performance of music like Star Wars and a showcase of all of our beginners And we even were planning to end the concert with all 140 students up on stage playing together.
Wow. So obviously with the stay-at-home ordering and any gatherings of more than 10 people not being allowed right now, that can't happen, unfortunately. And it seems like that there's a good chance that's going to extend beyond April 30th. So is there anything you can do to create music together when we're all being told to stay apart?
Well, the biggest challenge when we got these orders, and I, you know, realized very quickly that we wouldn't be able to have our big end of the year celebration, was how do we keep what we're trying to teach relevant, and how do we kind of keep it coordinated with so many teachers and so many students? And very early on, I started seeing in my own social media feed some wonderful examples from professional organizations all over the world of virtual orchestras. And I thought, goodness gracious, let's try to figure out how to do a virtual orchestra in string projects so that we can still stay connected. So I've partnered with one of our students from Creative Technologies, and we are in the process of learning our parts so that we can create a virtual orchestra project of our own.
So I understand a couple of your string project students are with us, Gideon Rogers and Joaquin Herrante. Thank you both for being here. And Gideon, I'd like to ask you, what grade are you in?
I am in fourth grade.
Fourth grade, okay. And Joaquin, what about you?
I'm in seventh grade.
Seventh grade, okay. What instruments do you both play?
Violin.
Violin, okay. You know, I think our listeners would love to hear a little of what you've been working on so hard this year. Gideon, can you share some of your music with us?
Sure, I'm going to play Ode to Joy.
Okay. That was lovely. Thank you, Gideon. And Joaquin, I understand you're going to be playing the viola part of that. And I think listeners should know this would normally be accompanied by a violin, cello, and bass for the full instrumentation. Thank you, Joaquin. That was great. That was great. Kate, let's now talk about some of your students at ISU proper. For someone majoring in music performance, can you talk about the importance of the senior or graduate recital?
Yes, the final recital is really our capstone project. And so it's more than just about, you know, getting up there and playing music that they've been working on in some cases for over a year. But it's really a celebration of family and friends. They often invite, you know, family comes from all over the country. It usually involves dressing up and, you know, buying a new dress or a new outfit. There's often food involved afterwards, a reception. So it really becomes, you know, kind of one of the most important rite of passages in their lives, you know, almost in some cases more important than the graduation itself, because it's just theirs. It's their project. You know, they enjoy showing off the campus, which is beautiful this time of year, and our really beautiful town. So it's a kind of a big deal for them. And it's hard to, as an instructor, to help get that same enthusiasm about getting the recital repertoire together, knowing that we're not going to have that really celebration together in person.
And I guess it takes a lot of time to sort of get ready for this. So what do you, as an instructor, what do you advise your students to do? Do you, if you can't have the real public concert, does the show have to go on?
Well, the show has to go on because it is part of the requirements for the degree. So we do want them to graduate this spring, and that will be anticlimactic for seniors all over the state and the country. So they have a couple options. They can either do a live stream performance, which some of them do anyway during the actual live performance. Some of them have been using Facebook or other platforms to live stream the performances. And so they can, you know, set up a microphone in their living room and give a recital that we can all tune into. Or they can opt to just send their studio teacher a recording of their recital music. So it's definitely not the same experience.
Well, I want to bring in two of your students. Rhoda Roberts and Chris Amann are with us. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
And Chris, let's begin with you. What is your instrument, and where are you in your studies?
I play the viola, and I am a grad student getting a degree in viola performance and string pedagogy. This is actually my last semester of graduate school.
Okay, well, congratulations on that. Were you? I take it then you were preparing for a recital.
Yes, my recital was originally scheduled for April 4th, actually.
Oh, goodness. But
with everything going the way it is, it'll have to be rescheduled for later on this month.
Okay. And so do you know, how are you planning to do it? Are you planning to have a virtual recital, Facebook Live or something like that?
I believe I will. It just depends. One of the problems that we've had with this whole stay-at-home order and, you know, not being within, you know, 6 to 10 feet of each other, is the problem with having like a piano accompaniment. I won't be able to do that. So, I'm not sure. I'm still trying to figure that out with how I'm going to do my recital.
Yeah. And I guess that's, people may not realize that, but if you are, playing a solo instrument like that, it's not just you on the stage the whole time. There's usually a piano player accompanying for most of those pieces. Rhoda, I want to ask you, what is your instrument, and where are you in your education?
I am a senior and I play violin.
Okay. And were you also preparing for a recital this semester?
Yes, I was. I'm not going to live stream mine though. I'm going to actually record it, send it to my teacher. I'll be doing the recording on April 19th. Okay. And then I hope to do a recital after the stay up home. Home order is over, maybe like the summer or even this fall.
Sure.
So I can actually still have the get together with my friends and things.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess you sort of meet the requirements, as you have to, but then you can still have the celebration later. Well, can I ask Rhoda, I don't know if you want to go first, if you can share a little bit of what you're working on for your recital.
Sure. I'm going to, you want me to play something?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, this is from Telemann's Fantasy Number 2 for solo violin. I'm going to play the second allegro.
Okay. Thank you. That was great. And Chris, final request, same request of you. Can we hear a little bit of what you've been working on for your capstone graduate school recital?
Sure. I will be playing the Gigue from Johann Sebastian Bach's second suite in D minor.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. That was great. You know, playing with or in front of an audience, I would imagine, Chris, is such an important part of music. And we've got just about a minute left in our conversation today. But can you talk about how does it change your relationship with the music to be presumably by yourself in front of a screen as opposed to with a room full of people?
I think what it comes down to is just that we as musicians, we work so hard for these pieces and these performances, and to really be able to show them in person is just very exciting, to be surrounded by people you love, your friends, your colleagues, your family, you know, all that type of stuff. To be able to just perform it in person, there's like a kind of a magic that happens during a performance where it's like the culmination of all of the stress, all of the time that we put into these pieces to finally just be able to go out and say, I love music, this is what I'm doing, and I'm going to play for you. So doing it over like a recorded recital or performance over through a screen, it's just a little bit different because you don't have that in-person touch, I guess.
Chris Amon is a graduate student at Illinois State University. We were also joined by his fellow student, senior Rhoda Roberts, as well as string project musicians Gideon Rogers, who's in fourth grade, and Joaquin Herrante, who's in seventh grade. They were all joined as well by their instructor, Kate Lewis, who's an associate professor of viola at Illinois State University. Thank you all so much for being here and sharing your music with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Since we first broadcast that conversation more than a month ago, the ISU String Project's virtual orchestra went from concept to reality. Let's take a listen. Student musicians from Bloomington Normal, part of the String Project at Illinois State University. We'll have the full video of the performance on our website, 21stshow.org. Coming up, why the pandemic might be the perfect time to pick up a hobby, maybe the viola. That's after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Most of us are living through a pandemic for the first time. Our lives have been upended, and all of us are feeling a lot of uncertainty and fear about what's to come, not to mention how long these social distancing measures will last. But as the stay-at-home order continues and regular life remains on pause, some people are fortunate to have a little extra time to focus on hobbies at home. Our next guest says, in some ways, now is the perfect time to invest in our passion projects, or maybe just find one. Elizabeth Segrin is a staff writer at Fast Company. She's also the author of The Rocket Years, How Your 20s Launched the Rest of Your Life, which has a whole chapter devoted to hobbies and interviews with hobby scholars. I spoke with Elizabeth in early April, just a few weeks after the stay-at-home order began. Elizabeth Segrin, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there may be some people who say, look, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I've got a lot of worries right now. Even if I'm staying at home more, picking up a hobby right now seems, I don't know, sort of frivolous maybe. But I understand you spoke with some researchers who say that hobbies are actually good for us.
Yeah, as I was working on this book, I discovered that a lot of people spend their 20s focused on things like their careers and their relationships, which are really important things. But actually, there's a lot of research that suggests that focusing on our passion projects and our hobbies is actually very important for our lifelong physical and mental health. I spoke to a lot of researchers who did a lot of research about this. They're actually, if you believe it or not, they're actually hobbies researchers out there. And what they found is that hobbies are actually really important for maintaining happiness throughout your life. They're really good for improving your productivity. And they're actually also very good for ensuring that you can stave off things like memory loss and Alzheimer's. And so really, while we tend to think of our hobbies as frivolous and things that we might neglect to spend time on, they actually have a much more important impact on our life than we might imagine.
I got to pause on this. Hobbies scholars or hobbies researchers. I'm really questioning my life choices right now. What is that?
I know, me too. Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who think about what hobbies really are. And hobbies are actually much more profound than we give them credit for. Hobbies are actually important because they're connected to our passions, right? And most of us spend our lives investing in our work, which is something that many of us are passionate about, in our families. But hobbies are actually a third realm of passion in our lives. And for many of us, we pick hobbies that are aligned with our identities. And so when we pursue our hobbies, we're actually connecting to a really important part of who we are. And a lot of people report feeling most themselves when they're pursuing a hobby. So there are plenty of psychologists and sociologists who actually study this, because the impact on hobbies on our lives is actually more profound than you might imagine.
So where do these hobby researchers work? Are these sort of tenured university positions, or do they like...
Yeah, there are sociologists who have devoted their entire careers to hobbies, and historians who have studied what hobbies are. And actually, that's a really fascinating thing. And that's because, you know, hobbies only really emerged in the Victorian era, when we had more time on our hands to invest in these things. You know, until that point, only very wealthy people had time to spend on things outside of their work. And, you know, in the Victorian era, people began to have a little bit more time to invest in these other parts of their lives. And in the modern era, we now have more time to spend on these things that that actually nurture, you know, ourselves. And It's a difficult time that we're all in right now, and a lot of us are stuck at home with a lot of extra time on our hands. But perhaps we can see this time as an opportunity to invest in some of these things that make us happy and that make us feel more productive and make us feel more like ourselves in this time when the world seems upside down.
So what is the difference between a hobby and a relaxing activity, right? Is my, you know, going through the entire back catalog of Star Trek Voyager, is that a hobby?
Yeah, it's interesting. So there are many definitions of hobbies, but they generally center on these two qualities. A hobby is something that you are very passionate about, but a hobby is also something that involves some level of skill. And in fact, when you think about hobbies, one person's hobby might actually be another person's job. You know, you think about hobbies like, for instance, playing an instrument or photography or flower arranging. Something that you might pursue as a hobby might actually be something that somebody else does for a living. So they involve a skill of some kind. And it's actually that skill which makes the hobby an interesting thing. It allows us to engage our minds and keep pursuing and challenging ourselves to pick up these skills throughout our life. And that's actually part of the reason why hobbies are so engaging. And actually, on that point, the fact that you have to keep learning new skills to keep pursuing this hobby over time is precisely why hobbies are recommended as a really important way to stave off all kinds of memory loss and other issues that might come with age, because engaging your brain and forcing yourself to sort of pick up new skills and deepen your skills over time is actually really, really good for your brain's health.
So why is now, this time when many of us are under these stay-at-home orders, why is now a good time to focus on trying to pick up a hobby?
So I would make the argument that we're in this very odd time, but this period actually has a couple of characteristics. One is that a lot of us have extra time on our hands, and it's time that many of us, myself included, we're filling with a lot of nervous energy. I don't know about you, but I'm spending a lot of time, you know, not doing a lot of the things I used to do before. But not really using that time very productively. I'm scanning the news a lot and feeling very anxious. And so I think that hobbies could be a way to help deal with this anxiety, because hobbies really force you to take your focus away from whatever it is that you're doing and spend a little bit of time in a very concentrated way on something that you enjoy, right? You pick a hobby because it's connected to something that is part of who you are and that makes you happy. And so giving yourself the opportunity to focus your mind on something else, and that something that makes you you feel happy, I think is a very good thing to do with your time right now.
And it structures your time, right? Gives a little order to your life.
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking about this, that, you know, we've been in this period of self-isolation for some time now. And for me anyway, I'm beginning to feel like all the days are blending together. And I think that it can be very useful to create some structure and order in our day. Many of us are working from home, and that makes a lot of sense. But perhaps spending a little bit of time every day at the same time, pursuing a hobby, getting better at it, you know, learning a new chord progression on your guitar, learning a new stitch, whatever it is that you're doing, spending a little bit of time on that will allow you to carve out time during the day and also maybe, you know, make you feel a little happier.
I have this fantasy. I don't know if you remember the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray, where he, you know, by some accounts, spends thousands of years reliving Groundhog Day and becomes a master piano player and all this stuff. And I guess that's kind of the goal here.
Not bad, Mr. Connors. You say this is your first lesson?
Yes, but my father was a piano mover, so...
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel right now. It's kind of the same day as repeating itself every day. But if we can become master piano players, or, you know, expert knitters, or, you know, amazing gardeners, you know, all the better, right?
Yeah. So you said in researching your book chapter for the Rocket Years on hobbies, you found that they're actually a way for us to connect with our identity. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the book, I spent a lot of time thinking about the big decisions that we make in our 20s. And our 20s are really this period in our life when we're writing our own origin stories about who we are and what we want from life. And in that period, what we're really doing is we're picking out and we're understanding what our major passions in life are. And those passions can involve the things that we do for work, the relationships that we have with other people. But our hobbies are also part of that, because there are so many things that we enjoy doing that we can't get out of those other facets of our life. And so that's largely what hobbies are. And doing a hobby allows you to sort of feel like yourself. And what's really awesome about hobbies is that you don't actually have to be that good at them. There are lots of things that you might enjoy doing that you're not particularly good at. And while in your career, it really helps for you to be an expert in that field and talented in that field, there are lots of things that you could do as a hobby that don't require you to be the very best. And I think that that's actually a really wonderful thing. So let me tell you a little bit about my hobbies. I'm now knitting. I've picked up knitting, and I will tell you, I am a terrible knitter. I'm also trying to do a bit more baking, and I would say like my cookies are not that great, but I really enjoy doing that, and it makes me really feel happy, and it makes me feel like I'm doing something that is an expression of who I am. And I think that is a really fulfilling thing. And I hadn't had an opportunity to really invest in these things before, but it's really helping me sort of feel a little bit more like myself at a time when nothing in my life feels normal.
So I know your book is focused on the 20 people in their 20s, but for those of us in the 30 and older set, I hope it's not too late. And if not, how do you recommend we go about finding a hobby?
Oh, it's absolutely not too late at all. And actually, I think that what's really important is that the reason that a lot of us pick up our hobbies in our 20s is because, you know, our brain chemistry hasn't sort of solidified yet. And therefore, it's a lot easier for us to pick up hobbies when we're younger because our brains just pick up new skills faster. But actually, as we get older, it's actually a little bit, it takes a little bit more time sometimes for us to pick up a new hobby, but that's precisely why it's important for us to be doing that, because that process of learning something new is actually really, really good for our brain. And so what I would say is that based on the research that I did for my book, what I've learned is that as we get older, it might feel like it's taking us a little bit longer to pick up on things that might have been easier when we were younger. And so sometimes it's good for us to be patient with ourselves in that process, because it's easy to become frustrated. But it's even more worthwhile to do it then, because your brain is actually, it's actually sort of preserving itself in that process. And it's actually staving off a lot of, you know, diseases like Alzheimer's that we're wary of.
So one of your bucket list items, I understand, was learning to make your grandmother's chicken curry. And we've only got about a minute left, but how's that going?
It's not going so well.
Sorry to hear that.
My mother actually taught it to my husband because she just wanted to make sure that at least one of us would figure it out. But I'm. I
feel like that's a whole like therapy session right there.
Yeah, that's we'll save that for another day. But you know what? Just going through the process of trying to learn that day by day is giving me something really valuable to do. And hopefully I'll figure it out and one day be able to pass it on to my daughter.
Elizabeth Segrin is a staff writer at Fast Company. She's also the author of The Rocket Years, How Your 20s Launched the Rest of Your Life, which has a whole chapter devoted to hobbies and interviews with hobby scholars. I originally spoke with her back in April. That's all the time we have for today and for this week. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just look for us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. We tweet out links with more analysis and background about what we've been talking about. Our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've got all our past shows there. You can also find us most places you can get your podcasts. We're on Spotify as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.